Likewise. You hungry, Rafe? Asked Vera. Give me the reins, Matthias, and dig out some food from the basket. I'll have an egg. Peeled, if you please. So he handed over Bessie's reins and peeled them both an egg, offered one to Rafel, but he refused. Strange days, the young man said, and shook his head. I never thought I'd live to see them. None of us did, Rafe, said Vera sadly, and dabbed salt from her fingers with her tongue. But it's why we're here, why the circle was formed. Sooner or later these days were bound to arrive.
That's true, agreed Rafel.
A small silence fell, bloated with words unspoken. He broke it, eventually, saying, And it's really him? The innocent mage?
Yes, Rafe, said Vera. It's really him.
Matt felt his throat close. He couldn't imagine what this young man was feeling, or know the depth of his courage, his honour. Turning a little so he could see that disconcerting face, he said,
I'd like to thank you, Rafel.
The young man looked at the sun-splashed passing countryside. No need. We're all born with different things to do. This is mine.
There is need. Asher, the innocent mage, he's my friend.
Matt said.
You're saving my friend. I wanted you to know that, is all.
Ah, said Rafel, and smiled. That's good. That's nice. Saving a kingdom's a grand thing to do, but it feels a tittle bit impersonal. Saving your friend, though, that makes a difference.
You won't be forgotten, he insisted. He won't forget you, although you'll never meet.
None will forget our Rafel, said Vera, a warning note in her voice. I'll take the pony now, Matthias. You forage in that basket again and find me some sweet plum cake. And from here on in, I think we'll get used to calling you by a different name. No sense advertising who you are.
Changing my name is easy, Matt said. But what about my face? I'm well known in the city. Even with a hooded cloak and darkness to hide in, there's a chance I'll be recognized. I heard you tell Daphne you had some trick.
Vera nodded.
That I do. But I'll wait a while before I play it. I'm not sure how long it'll hold.
That didn't sound encouraging, but she was looking so sad he didn't have the heart to press further. Instead, he smiled and nodded, saying,
Whatever you think best, Vera.
She dug his ribs with her elbow.
I think plum cake's best. Didn't I say so? You're a bit young to be deaf, aren't you?
As Rafel chuckled and Vera pretended flouncy offence, Matt handed over the reins and dragged the basket into his lap.
Here you are, mistress, he said with mock civility,
and dropped a lump of moist cake in her lap.
Why, thank you, Meister. Meister...
Her lips pursed as she thought about it.
Maitland, I think,
she finished at last.
I knew a Maitland once. A right silly fool if ever I met one, and definitely hard of hearing.
Matt swallowed a snort, exchanged amused glances with Rafel, and took the reins back from Vera so she could enjoy her cake. Darren was industriously polishing the staircase banister when Willa returned to the tower. The foyer doors flung open without so much as a knock, and the horrid little man sauntered in, reeking of arrogance and pomposity. He flung down his polishing cloth, not bothering to hide his contempt.
In Baal's sweet name, Willa, what do you want now? We gave you old Derm's books, I promise.
I've a message for Gar, said Willa, smirking. From His Majesty King Conroyd.
He nearly slapped the smug and shiny face in front of him, had to pinch his fingers together behind his back to stop himself.
Not Gar, he said icily. His Royal Highness, the Prince. Call his name like a commoner one more time, and you'll live to regret it.
Willa's eyes narrowed to ugly slits.
"Threaten me one more time, and you'll not live at all," he hissed. "Bulletin has no relevance now. You're an old man serving a destitute and deluded outcast cripple, while I am personal assistant to the king, his strong right arm, his trusted companion."
"His lackey, you mean," scoffed Darren. "His scuttling errand boy. What's this message, then? Give it me and I'll take it to His Highness." Willa went to push past him.
"I'll tender it myself. Stand aside, old crow. Don't interfere with the king's own business unless you fancy sharing cold straw with Asher."
Blocking him, Darren leaned his face close.
"His Highness is sleeping, and I'll not see him woken. Not by the likes of you. And as for threats, Willa, I make you no threats. Only this promise. Harass my prince unduly, cause him a heartbeat's more pain, and you'll never know another day's peace. I will destroy you, and no one shall touch me for doing it."
Whatever Willa saw in his face then, it must have been convincing. The little worm turned sickly pale and stepped back a pace.
"Very well. Take him the message yourself. It's of no account to me. His Majesty commands Prince Gar's attendance at the execution of the traitor Asher. A carriage will be sent here 30 minutes before midnight tonight. The prince is advised to be ready and waiting."
"I shall so inform His Highness," Darren said. "Now get out." For a long time after Willa's huffy departure, he stood in the foyer, feeling ill, feeling old and helpless. Then, because delay was fruitless, he climbed the staircase to Gar's apartments and prayed he would not weep. "What is it?" said Gar, not looking up from Baal's diary. He was covered in ink, his fingers, his face, long blue streaks in his hair. He'd wiped his hands on his lovely rose silk waistcoat, ruining it forever. The desktop was scattered with scribblings, the floor littered with discarded notes. He looked stretched thin as a wire. Standing in the library doorway, afraid to step in closer, Darren cleared his throat.
"A message, sir, from His Majesty."
Gar kept on writing, one inky finger tracing a line in the diary, his brow deep furrowed with strain. "I'm busy. Tell me later."
"I think, sir," he said carefully, "I should tell you now."
"Then tell me and go away," Gar shouted. "Can't you see what I'm doing?" Darren told him, quickly to get it over with, then watched, unwilling but unable not to, as the meaning and the meanness of Geralt's command sunk into Gar's understanding. The prince's fingers trembled and dropped the pen.
"So," he murmured unseeing, "it's not enough that I condemn him. I must also watch him die. Oh, Conroy, Conroy, is this how much you hated us?"
Darren withdrew and closed the door before it was impossible to pretend he hadn't seen Gar's grief. By early afternoon, Bessie's unflagging walk-jog-walk had carried them without incident to the turn-off onto the main city road. Now there was traffic. Carriages and dog-carts and saddle-horses, all bearing Olkin, all flowing in a steady stream towards Dorina. Still driving, his back aching now, Matt stared at them, stabbed through with a furious dismay.
"What's the matter with them?"
he muttered to Vera.
"Don't they know it's bloodshed and murder they're going to see?"
"Judicious murder," said Vera. "There's a difference."
"What difference?" he retorted. "The blood spilled's not as red."
She shook her head.
"It's not red at all, Maester Maitland. It's black. Black as the heart of the bad man who's dying."
"You don't believe that?"
"Of course not. But they do."
She patted his knee.
"They have to. If they let themselves think for one moment this might not be just... Well, folks like to put an untroubled head on their pillow at night, don't they? And it's harder still for us Ulkin. If we don't condemn a dabbling in magic, it's the same as shouting we'd like to try it ourselves.
It made him so angry he could easily have shouted himself. Behind them in the back of the cart, Rafel snored softly, curled up beneath a canvas coverall. It was no use. He had to ask.
When the time comes, Vera, how will you do it?
Kindly, she said after a moment. There's herbs in the brew I concocted, as will ease him gently on his way. When all's said and done, Matthias, it's not so different from a dog or a cat that's aged past saving.
Except that it was, and she knew it, and so did he. Nor was it the answer he'd looked for, but it wasn't in him to press her further. This time he patted her knee, then took her hand in his to hold and squeeze. She didn't pull away. He guided Bessie onto City Road and let silence fall again for 3 more miles. Then, still holding her hand, he said,
It could be me, Vera, but I think Dath's not looking like herself.
She grunted without comment and started poking in the basket for a cake crumb she'd missed the last 6 times she'd looked.
She had more colour to her the last time I saw her, he added. Of course, it might just be the worry.
Might be, agreed Vera. There's a lot to be worried about, I know that much.
And she wasn't eating.
Worry can do that to an appetite, I'm told.
Wretched old woman. She wasn't going to say. If he wanted to have his suspicions about Daphne's condition confirmed, he'd have to ask the question outright, and even then he thought she'd probably feign sudden deafness. He chose another topic instead, one equally as vexing.
If we manage this, Vera, if your mad plan works and we get Asher out of Dorna with his head still attached, and ours too for that matter...
She gave him a hard look.
He'll be grateful.
For how long? Will he still be grateful when he finds out the truth and how it's been kept from him all this time? When he learns how I've lied and Daphne's lied, all to make some prophecy he's never heard of come true?
He's the innocent mage, said Vera, quietly fierce. He's got prophecy in his blood and bones, whether he knows it or not. He'll do what he's born for, never you fear.
She was the Circle Guardian, wise in things he'd never even thought of, but still he was driven to disagree.
We've all been so set on what we want, how he fits into our plans. But Vera, what about his plans and what he wants? Magic's meant nothing but hardship and heartbreak for Asher. Look what it's doing to him now. I don't know if there's enough gratitude in all the kingdom, let alone one man's heart, to dull the pain of these past days, or douse his anger when he finds out how he's been duped, and who's done the duping.
He was making her angry. Her lips tightened and her fingers fisted in her lap.
He loves her, Matthias.
And she loves him, I know, he sighed. But she lied before she loved him, while she loved him, after she loved him. Is it 'cause you're both women that you can't see the blow you'll deal his pride?
She fixed her gaze to the carriage up ahead.
Pride's of no consequence where prophecy's concerned.
He shut his mouth. Could be she was right and he was wrong. Could be Asher would take it all in his stride, forgive the lies, the manipulation, the nudgings here and there to put him where he was wanted and when. Could be he'd embrace prophecy and all its mysterious workings as willingly as he'd embraced Daphne when he thought she was only a woman who once worked in a bookshop. If he did, well and good. And if he didn't, what could they do about it anyway? They lived their lives at the mercy of prophecy, and prophecy, as always, would do as it willed.
We'll not discuss it any more, said Vera. What's done is done, and there's no turning back. Why don't you climb in with young Rafel and get a little shut-eye? You need to be rested for what lies ahead.
What about you? You need rest too, and...
The smallest flash of teeth as she smiled.
And I'm old? True enough, Meister Maitland. But I'm old like Bessie's harness leather is old. Tough, well looked after and hard to break. Rest. I'll wake you when we're closer to the city, and it's time to play our trick.
She'd have her way, he could see that. So he clambered over the driver's seat and into the cart's cramped belly, trying not to tread on snoring Rafel. How the man could sleep, knowing what lay ahead for him, was a mystery. Even though she was right, and he was very tired, Matt doubted he would sleep. But a moment after he'd closed his eyes to think on Vera's words, the old woman was shaking his shoulder and urging in his ear,
Meister Maitland, Meister Maitland, come along now. Doran is in sight. Wake up. It's time to fix your face.
She was in the back of the wagon with him. Opening his eyes, he sat up and saw the sun had set, and the night was flickered with torches. Four burned brightly at each corner of their wagon. Rafel, taking his turn with the reins, had guided them to the side of the road. Traffic had dwindled to a trickle, and they were, for the moment, alone. Lit up with glimfire, the city walls gleamed in the distance, no more than half an hour away. He hadn't thought to sleep so long.
Lie on your back and keep your head down, Vera told him softly. And no matter what happens, don't cry out. This shouldn't be downright painful, but you might well feel a tingle or two.
Why?
He whispered, lowering himself to the wagon floor.
What are you planning? What's this trick you've come up with?
To be truthful, dear, I'm not quite sure. Something to take the edge off your fine good looks, I'm hoping.
She settled on her haunches beside him.
Now, close your eyes and let down your defences. I need you quite open for this.
Nervous, but trusting her, he settled into himself, loosening the fetters he kept round his mind, sinking into the fabric of the world around him, and nearly choked on a scream of pain and surprise. It was like breathing in fire or poison or something of both. What is it? What's happened? Demanded Rafel, peering over his shoulder.
Matthias! Matthias!
Vera's voice was an anchor, a saving grace. He clutched at her, desperate for the touch of wholesome flesh beneath his fingers. His mind felt fouled, smeared, contaminated with evil. Gasping, he fought the urge to empty his belly all over her.
It's back! Vera, can't you sense it? Dark, sticky, wicked. Worse than ever I felt it before. Stronger, almost alive.
He pressed his fists against his mouth to hold the horror inside, struggled to regain his balance, his serenity, when the thing he could feel pulsing at the heart of the kingdom's magic wanted nothing more than chaos and destruction. Vera's hands were cradling his head against her belly. She was holding him, rocking him.
All right, all right. Just you breathe easy, child. Make sure you're all closed up again. Maybe it's alive and maybe it isn't, but we don't want to go flapping our hands in front of its face if it is, now do we?
Heartbeat by heartbeat, the awful feeling passed and he was able to sit up.
That was horrible.
It looked it, said Rafel, shaken. Are you sure you're all right?
I will be.
He stared at Vera.
I think it's what prophecy warned of. The thing we must fight in the final days.
She pulled a face.
I don't doubt that at all.
I don't think we can fight it, Vera,
he whispered, starting to shiver.
Not that. It's too big, too black and hungry, if this is what Daphne's been dreaming.
A wave of revulsion engulfed him.
I don't know how she can live with it. I don't know how she's not mad.
She's Javale's heir, said Vera. It's what she was born for. And saving Asher's what we were born for, so we'd best be on about it. Lie down again, Matthias, and this time, don't open your mind. I'm going to try my trick another way.
Reluctantly, he did as she bade. Eyes closed, he felt her fingers spread across his face. Beneath their touch, his skin grew warm, hot, burning. It twitched and crawled and seemed to seethe. He could hear her whimpering, whimpered a little himself.
There,
she said at last, sounding exhausted, and pulled her hands away.
I call it blurring. Raphael, what do you think?
Javale, save us,
Raphael said, hushed and fearful.
How did you do that? That's not his face.
Which would be the idea?
Said Vera, acerbic.
Matthias, can you hear me?
He grunted.
Yes, and see you too. Your nose is bleeding. What have you done to my face?
Nothing much, she said, fishing in her pocket for a kerchief. Rearranged the furniture a bit. Made sure no one in that city will look at you twice.
How? I could feel you channeling energy, shaping me, but...
Vera dabbed the kerchief at her lip and frowned at the bloodstains smeared on the cotton.
To be truthful, I'm not quite sure how it's managed. The idea came in a dream. I practiced on my own face a time or several. Gave myself a nasty fright, looking in the mirror. It's not the way our magic's normally used, and I wouldn't recommend it as a parlour game. But it'll do the trick tonight, and that's all I care about. Raphael, get this cart back on the road, young man. We've work to be getting on with.
As Raphael obeyed her, Matt sat up and explored his face with his fingertips. It was definitely different. Pockmarked, fatter. His lips felt rubbery and his nose was an awkward shape. He sighed.
You couldn't have made me handsome.
Vera just laughed and patted his knee. The rest of the journey was completed in silence. They reached the city's outer stone wall, passed beneath the shadow of its gates, trundling by Pelin Oryx guards unrecognized, unchallenged. Matt felt his crushing sense of dread ease so he could breathe again.
We've a horse stall saved for us in a private yard down the back of the livestock quarter, said Vera. Matt, you'd best drive us from here. You know where you're going.
So he took the reins from Raphael and guided Bessie in the cart through the crowded, glim-lit streets to the livestock district, past smelly pens of goats and sheep and yards crammed full of cattle and horses, where Vera directed him to an empty double stable decorated with a flapping green ribbon. Stiff and hungry, they shunted the cart into hiding, unharnessed the pony, and saw her safely settled with hay and water.
Now, said Vera, hefting her bag on her shoulder, I'm for a chamber pot, 'cause my bladders are bursting, and I'll bet yours are too. Then we'd best find our places in the square and settle ourselves for a long and fractious wait.
Matt watched her march away, suddenly numb. Then he turned to Raphael, who hadn't bothered to pull his own knapsack from the cart. Well, why would he? He wasn't going to need it again.
Are you sure you want to go through with this?
He asked Vera's calm-faced nephew.
It's not too late to change your mind.
Raphael smiled, softly and sadly, not the kind of smile he'd ever seen on Asher's face.
Thanks, Matthias. But it was always too late to change my mind.
After that, there was nothing left to say. Without thinking, Matt embraced him, felt Raphael's fear and trembling courage. Then, side by side and silent, they followed in Vera's footsteps. Part 4. Chapter 29. Damn, thought Gar, and threw down his pen. Ancient Doranan grammar was a quagmire, and he was rapidly sinking. Remembering his blithe assurances that he could easily read the books they'd found in Baal's hidden library, he winced. What a shame there was no way of getting back in there. Perhaps his ancestors had thought to bring some school text with them, an introduction to basic old tongue, for instance. But the long-lost vault's door was warded against him, and there was no way now of breaking in. And besides, he could read all the other books he'd taken from those dusty shelves. It was only Baal's diary that was proving a challenge. A deliberate attempt to foil prying eyes? Or was tortured self-expression just one more thing that made her unique? A tentative knuckle rap on the chamber's closed door interrupted his profitless inner complaints. He looked up. "What is it?" The door swung open on soundless hinges, revealing Darren. Gar bit his lip, pinched with conscience. The old man looked tired. It was asking too much for him to caretake this whole tower by himself, and Conroy knew it. Bastard. Instead of sitting warm and cozy in this library, he should be helping Darren, prince or no prince. But nothing was more important than translating Baal's diary. Not even an old man's precarious health.
"I'm so sorry to disturb you, sir, but I thought you should know. The carriage will be here in an hour."
An hour? Was it that late? Had he really been sitting here without stirring for nearly 7 hours? Startled, he looked at the clock on the fireplace mantel and saw that, yes, he had. 7 hours, and only 5 more pages deciphered to show for it. Abruptly, he was aware of muscles aching, of a belly growling for food and a bladder in need of emptying. Stifling a groan, he pushed his chair back and stood, hands pressed into the small of his back. "I thought you were going to bring me dinner." Darren sighed.
"I did."
Oh yes, so he did. And there it was, still untouched on its tray, which he'd ordered be put down somewhere, anywhere, just get out and leave him to work. Darren had left it on the side table next to the armchair. Shuffling out from behind his desk, Gar spared him a swift, apologetic smile. "Sorry." And as he reached out a hand to filch a slice of pinkly tender beef, Darren swooped, snatched the tray beyond his reach and retreated.
"It'll be stone cold by now, sir. I'll just go and heat it up for you."
He nodded. "Fine. And while you do that, I'll attend to my appearance. When you come back, make sure to bring a jug of ice wine with you. Unless, of course, Conroy saw fit to confiscate my cellar along with everything else."
"No," said Darren after a moment's hesitation. "No, you've still a supply of good vintage yet."
Obviously an oversight on Conroy's part.
"Obviously," said Darren, sniffing,
and returned to the kitchen. His head full of obscure phrasing and past participle constructions, Gar drifted upstairs to his bedchamber and set about putting himself to rights. Made sure to keep pondering those recalcitrant participles, because provided he remained focused on the subtle differences between having and keeping, then he was sure not to start thinking about why it was he had to bathe and shave and change his clothes. If he let himself think about why, there was a good chance he'd drop in his tracks like an arrow-struck stag and never get up again. By the time he returned downstairs, clean and refreshed and impeccably attired in black, efficient Darren had contrived to reheat his neglected dinner and unearth a particularly splendid jug of ice wine. Swigging it straight from the jug would be ungenteel, so he poured the ice wine neatly into a paper-thin crystal glass. Something else Conroy had neglected to steal. Really, the man was slipping, and drank without pause until it was empty. Assaulted with alcohol, his head spun a little. He smiled and poured a second glass. This time Darren had pointedly left the dinner tray on his desk, after tidily putting all his scribbled notes to one side. Gar sat down, speared the meat with his fork, and ate without tasting as he considered again Baal's diary and the entries he'd transcribed so far.
"I am afraid," she had written. "In the madness of war we slipped away, but I know we can't hide forever. Morgan brooks no interference, nor leaves unpunished the slightest transgression, and my crime against him is not slight. We swore an oath together, and he'll hold me to it or see me dead. By his reckoning, he loves me, and Tala, forgive me. I love him, loved him, loved the man he used to be, not the monster he's become. I must find a way to defeat that monster, else surely we are doomed, and all the world with us."
There was no indication when or where she'd recorded that entry. Most likely it was during the terrible flight from Dorana, before she and her fellow refugees stumbled into the sleepy land of Lur. Another entry, some time later. "Two more of our children died today. We buried them in an Ulken graveyard. These simple people are good and kind. I can't repay them with bloodshed and destruction. There must be a way to keep this fertile land safe." And another, still later.
"He is coming. He is coming. I can feel it. Tabitha and Jarrett say I'm just dreaming. They say Morgan is dead. Must be dead. The mage wars were unsurvivable. But I know otherwise. I've not told a soul of the power we discovered, the key to immortality. If I told them, they'd see me as Morgan in their midst, and I'd be killed out of hand, I'm certain. And if I die, there'll be no stopping him."
Immortality? Gar pushed his dinner aside and poured himself more wine. It seemed no more likely on this second reading than it had the first. Immortality was a myth, a dream. Not even the ancient Dorinan, magicians powerful beyond the imaginings of their tamer descendants, could aspire to such a feat. Could they? She'd said more about it further on. "There is some risk in the making of this wall. Not great, however, and I am a master magician. Morgan's equal, though he was always loath to admit it. When it is done and Lur is forever sealed safe behind it, I think I shall honour my oath to Morgan and transmute myself immortal, not for any base desire for power, or to feed some gross appetite for worship. I am not Morgan. I'll do it because I know he lives and will change himself soon if he hasn't already. Then he will find us, no matter how long it takes to search each corner of the world. When he does, I must be waiting for him. 10 years. 100. 1,000. He will come, and I must face him. Defeat him. No other magician lives who might stand in his way." Gar sat back in his chair, shaking his head, poured himself a third glass of wine and drank it faster than such a superb vintage deserved. Insanity. What he'd translated was insanity, the exhausted ramblings of a woman in shock, in mourning and soaked to the marrow in grief. No one could live 1,000 years, which was a shame, really. To speak with Baal, a historian's dream.
"Sir?"
Rudely jerked from gentle fantasy, he looked up. Darren again, hovering like a... what was it Asher used to call him? A constipated scarecrow? In the library's open doorway. Asher. Damn. And he'd been doing so well not thinking of him.
"Sir?"
Tentatively, Darren entered the room.
"I'm sorry. His Majesty's carriage awaits you."
"Does it?" He flicked a glance at the mantel clock. It was a half hour till midnight, exactly. Slowly, Deliberately, he poured himself more wine, lifted the glass, and admired the way the firelight shafted through the pale green liquid within. How prompt he is. A man of his word.
Yes, sir, said Darren. Sir, please, you have to leave now.
He let his gaze shift to Baal's secret diary, his last hope of salvation, Asher's last hope of life. Hours of work, and he was only halfway through it, with no answers found, no miracles revealed. And now time had run out. He emptied the fresh glass of ice wine down his throat in one long, burning rush. Darren's expression was disapproving, but that was just too bad. If he thought his prince could get through this night sober, he was very sadly mistaken. With delicate precision, he placed the wine glass on the desk and stood for Darren's inspection. Well, how do I look? Don't say drunk. Darren's face was rigid.
You look very proper, sir.
He smiled, as bright and brittle as the ice wine churning in his belly. Are you sure you won't come with me? I expect there'll be room for one more. Darren flinched.
Thank you, sir, but no. I'm content to forego the pleasure.
And it will be a pleasure. For many.
Alas, sir. Yes, said Darren, and stepped backwards, hinting. Sir,
I know, he snapped. The carriage is waiting. Darren followed him downstairs and opened the tower doors for him. Ordinary torchlight spilled inside. He could have asked Conroy to arrange for Glimfire, but knowing how much pleasure refusal would give, he'd refrained, even though it meant more work for Darren. At the bottom of the tower steps, there was indeed a carriage, blazoned with House Geralt's crest. The falcon now wore a thunderbolt crown. For a moment, he thought he was going to lose his bulwark of ice wine down the front of his black silk tunic. Seeing him, one of Conroy's lackeys jumped off the carriage's rear travelling step and opened the nearest door.
I'll wait up for you, sir, said Darren,
standing back from the door. His eyes were anxious. Gar started down the steps. Don't bother. I might be some time.
It's no bother, Darren called after him.
At the point of entering Conroy's ostentatious carriage, he paused and looked back. Fine. Suit yourself. He climbed inside. The lackey slammed the door and clambered back onto the travelling step. A whip crack, a creaking of harness and wood. Then they were moving. Gar let his head fall against the cushions and wished he were dead. Or really drunk. The square was a solid sea of Ulkin spectators wrapped warm against the midnight chill, packed on three sides around the space in the middle that still contained the cart and the cage and Asher. Conspicuous in blue and crimson, stationed at every opportunity amongst the crowd, beside the cage, wherever there was space to stand, and armed with both pike staffs and truncheons, were Pelin Oryk's city guard, looking keyed up, looking grim. The square's fourth side was taken up with an unusually elevated dais reserved for the king and such dignitaries as still remained in the city. Most of them were Ulkin too. Gar, staring through the carriage window as it rolled slowly to a halt, saw how few Dorinan sat with them and frowned. Odd. He'd imagined they'd be the most eager of all to see the upstart Ulkin die. The carriage door opened, and he got out, a few paces from the foot of the stairs attached to the dais. Heart uncomfortably thudding, he let his gaze touch the square and the people, but not the cage or its inhabitant, and only briefly, sickly, the block and the straw and the hooded man in black beside them, holding a sharpened silver axe. Was it the same man who'd dealt with Tim and Spake? He couldn't tell. Everything was lit as bright as day by the enormous balls of glimfire hovering overhead. There was a hissing snap as one of them shivered, showering sparks. A moment later, a second followed suit. Then a third. A few cries went up from those folks stung by the spitting magic. Payne Sorvold stood nearby in conversation with Noel Daltrey, two of Conroy's closest friends. Of course, they'd make sure to be here. Doubtless they expected high office in the new Doranan court. Seeing the uncertain glimfire, hearing the loud protests from the crowd, Sorvold broke off his amused rejoinder to some quip of Daltrey's and reinforced the stuttering magic. Turning back, Sorvold noticed Conroy's carriage and then the newest arrival. Excused himself to Daltrey and approached, his expression smoothed to a scrupulous politeness.
"Your Highness,"
he said, offering a token bow.
"His Majesty asked that I greet you and escort you to your seat. He will be here himself momentarily."
"Hoping for a grand entrance?" said Gar. His head was pounding. He'd not drunk nearly enough wine. "Typical. What's wrong with the glimfire?" Sorvold's eyes had widened at his comment, and his tone. He said, sounding wary,
"Nothing, sir. There's a lot of it up there, and larger than would normally be called, but you've no need for concern."
"Did I sound concerned?" he said. Sorvold took refuge behind formality.
"If you'd like to come with me, sir."
"Oh, Payne," he sighed. "There is nothing I would like to do less."
"Sir?"
"Never mind," he said curtly. "Let's go." As he fell into step beside Sorvold, he caught sight of Pelinoric, resplendent in crimson, standing some 10 feet away with his attention focused keenly on the crowd. Feeling eyes upon him, the captain turned, acknowledged the royal presence with a nod. Gar nodded back, wondering what went on behind that cold, composed face. He'd had the impression Auric and Asher were friendly, but if Auric was disturbed by any of this, he didn't show it. But then, nobody with any sense would show sorrow here tonight. He climbed the dais stairs behind Sorvold and followed him to the seat so thoughtfully reserved for him. Right down the front, of course, beside the elegant, elaborate chair clearly intended for Conroy. The good and ignorant people of his dead father's kingdom saw him, and a roar went up that threatened to rattle the stars.
"Gar! Gar! Ball bless our prince, Gar!"
He responded because he had no choice, nodding and waving and pretending he cared, that their wild acclaim meant something, and he was glad to be here. Then, as the cheering died down, he took his seat. Breathing deeply, he let his face become a mask. He could feel the speculative glances of those few Doranan lords and ladies who'd decided to attend the entertainment. People who once had begged his attendance at their parties and dances, who'd dreamed of him as a match for their daughters, who now doubtless wished he'd died along with his family, who found him inconvenient, an embarrassment. Not one of them spoke to him, or even approached, which suited him perfectly. Some minutes later, Balsman Holt arrived, decorated in his most costly clerical robes. The still jittery glimfire sparked and flashed on the rubies and sapphires sewn into his white brocade tunic. At his heels trailed Willa, swathed in dull green silk. The little man's air of self-importance bordered on the obscene as he shuffled himself into one of the seats to the rear of the dais, where apparently the oaken belonged. Hull sank into the chair on the other side of Conroy's empty imitation throne. Gar glanced down at the square and frowned. Hull's up here, and no sign at all of a Baal speaker's presence amongst the guards. Did this mean Asher was to be denied the consolation of a clerical attendance? No prayers, as there had been prayers for Timon Spake? It seemed there was no end to Conroy's casual cruelties.
"Your Highness,"
Holes said, with an almost imperceptible nod. Garin clenched his jaw. Balsman? Behind them a low buzz of voices as the other attendees distracted themselves with conversation. Holes leaned a little closer.
I hope you're reconciled to tonight's event. There can be no suggestion of ambivalence.
You think me ambivalent? He smiled. You're mistaken. A new roar from the crowd below killed Holes's cold-eyed reply.
The king! The king! Baal, bring us the king!
So Conroyd arrived in a sound storm of rapture that threatened not only to rattle the stars, but rain them down on all their heads. He was the king. He was their savior, the glorious golden Dornan who'd rescued them from a royal house well loved, but bled utterly dry of magic. He arrived draped in crimson, dappled with rubies, studded with diamonds. Riding Signet, the beautiful silver stallion Asher loved. For the first time since climbing out of Conroyd's carriage, Gar looked in the cage. Saw Asher, on his knees and staring with eyes gone hollow in a wounded face gone hollower still. He had to look away. Overhead, the glimfire furiously sparked and sputtered. Four balls extinguished themselves entirely and were hastily rekindled by Sorvold and Daltrey, still in attendance on the ground. All the while Conroyd sat on the fretting silver stallion and waved, laughing, drinking the applause avidly, gluttonously, as though too much could never be enough. Just as Gar thought he must be sick, Conroyd dismounted and tossed his reins to a waiting oaken servant, lightly leaped up the stairs to the top of the dais, and stood before his empty chair. Not once did he acknowledge his former king's existence.
"Good people," he cried, and the crowd fell silent. "Your love moves me to tears."
Mellifluous, musical, his glorious voice bathed them all in beauty.
"Midnight approaches. Justice awaits. Let it be done, and let all gathered here bear witness to Baal's mercy and might. Captain Auric!"
Pellin Auric appeared before him and bowed.
"Your Majesty."
"It is time, Captain. Do your duty."
The crowd shouted, drumming its heels to show approval. On the dais behind Gar, no such vulgar display, but the mood of self-satisfaction swelled. He watched, sickened, as Auric walked with slow deliberation across the square to the cage holding Asher. In one hand, he held a large key. To distract himself, Gar turned to Conroyd, seated now, and said softly, "It was supposed to rain here today. Did you forget?" Conroyd smiled, his attention on Auric.
"Be silent."
"Or haven't you even taken the weather magic yet? Conroyd, you mustn't delay. The people depend."
"Be silent," said Conroyd, "or lose your tongue."
He flinched. Was it his imagination playing tricks, or was there something wrong with Conroyd? Something different about him? His eyes? The way his skin stretched over his face? There was something, and it made his skin crawl. Three more balls of glimfire expired, and one exploded. Before Sorvold or Daltrey could act, Conroyd replaced them with a wave of his hand, nodded to Auric, who unlocked the cage, and handled Asher ungently into the square. Asher moved slowly, painfully, his chains clanking in the sudden hush. He looked up, and as their eyes met, Gar felt his heart seize, freeze. Darren had lied. There was no forgiveness in Asher's thinned and bloodless face, no understanding of acceptance, only hate and hate and hate. "Damn, Darren! damn Asher too, and Conroyd, the crowd, above all, damn himself. He wanted so much to believe in Asher's absolution, he'd deafened himself to the small voice within whispering, "What you do is unforgivable," had allowed himself to be deceived, because deception was so alluring and so desperately desired, and now was dead, as Asher would soon be dead. Oryk escorted his shuffling prisoner to the block, steadied Asher before it, and impersonally helped him to kneel. His kneeling broke the taut silence. The crowd shouted, cheered, drummed their heels again, ecstatic. Some of them sat so close to the block they were in danger, surely, of being soaked in spraying blood, of having their clothing ruined. Did they realize? Did they care? Or was it deliberate? An attempt to gain some kind of revolting keepsake? Remembering the horror of Timon Spake's beheading, Gar couldn't comprehend this lust for blood and death. These Olkan who howled for Asher's murder were the same men and women who, scant weeks ago, had fought to call him friend, to buy him ale, to boast to their cronies, "As I said to Asher himself just the other day." A touch to one shoulder, and Asher put his head on the block. Gar wanted to close his eyes, but couldn't. He owed his friend this much, not to close his eyes. With his hands and ankles chained, Asher couldn't keep his balance. He kept slipping sideways off the block, a final obscenity. Oryk looked up and Conroyd nodded. The chains were removed. Asher once more lowered his head, and Oryk stepped back, well out of the way. The executioner came forward, raised his axe. A gasp of indrawn breath ran round and through the waiting crowd, and all the glimfire went out. Plunging darkness, screams, confusion, Conroyd swearing. 1 minute passed, and then one more. A ball of glimfire bloomed, another, then another. Light returned, revealing Asher still kneeling at the block, passively awaiting death.
"Kill him!" screamed Conroyd, leaping to his feet. "Kill him now!"
The axe fell, blood sprayed, the crowd shrieked. A ball of glimfire directly overhead erupted into shooting flame and sank, igniting the bloody straw and Asher's sundered body. Panic, as those closest to the carnage tried to get away. Some of them were on fire. Panic spread and the crowd stampeded. Forgotten, held fast in some kind of frozen stillness, Gar watched as chaos held sway. Oryk and his guards tried and failed to maintain order. Balsman Holes shouted prayers and pleas for sanity. Conroyd's guests tumbled pell-mell off the dais, in fear for their lives. Willa was squealing. Gar couldn't help it. He laughed out loud. Conroyd turned on him, his altered face livid, the glimfire's dying flames reflected in his eyes.
"Is this your doing, eunuch? Is it?"
Despite his danger, he smiled. "Mine? How could it be? I'm a cripple, remember? Perhaps it's Baal expressing her displeasure." Conroyd struck him so hard that a ruby ring opened the flesh along his cheekbone.
"If I find this is you, runt, your pain will last forever."
Blood was pouring down his face. He groped for the kerchief Darren insisted he carry and pressed it to the wound.
"Are you mad, Conroyd? To assault me? In public?"
There was madness, or something worse, seething beneath the surface of Conroyd's chalk-white face.
"With me," he grunted. "Now!"
His arm bruised in an inescapable grip, Gar found himself dragged from his seat, from the dais, down the stairs and into the square where the stench of charred straw, blood, and human flesh was hideous. He gagged, retched, brought up all his swallowed ice wine in a frothy puddle at Conroyd's feet. Conroyd threw him to his knees in the middle of it.
"Look there," he commanded. "You know him better than any man alive. Is that him? Tell me if it's him, and if you lie, I'll see it, and no mercy known shall save you."
The body in its head had caught almost the full brunt of the flaming glimfire. The face was blistered, bubbled, oozing thick boiled blood, but it was ashes. The rest of the torso and its limbs were roasted, its clothes burned almost away. Only one small section of flesh was left seared, but unblackened, the right arm, from shoulder to inches above the wrist. In falling, the body had sheltered it from the worst of the flames. Gar stared at the smooth, unscarred length of limb, looked again at that terrible face, still recognizable, and then again at the unscarred arm. Like immortality, this was impossible.
"Is it Asher?" said Conroyd.
Churned with confusion, with the beginnings of a hope too great to admit, Gar pressed his hands to his face and let a sob burst from his throat.
"Damn you, Conroyd! Of course it is! He's dead! You've killed him!"
Cruel fingers tangled in his hair, dragging his head backwards to breakneck position.
"You swear it," said Conroyd, his terrible eyes on fire. "On pain of every punishment I've ever promised, and many more besides."
His slashed cheek was burning.
"Yes, yes, I swear it," he said. "Look at his face! See for yourself, it's Asher!"
Conroyd looked. "Yes," he said at last, in almost a whisper.
"It is him. I've won. My exile at last is ending."
His grasping fingers loosened, and he backed a pace away. Gar climbed unsteadily to his feet, certain of one thing only, that none of this made sense. He stared at Conroyd, who, for all his familiar cruelty, yet seemed subtly unlike himself. And even as he watched, something rippled across that hated face, some alchemical change that suggested, for a single impossible moment, that he was looking not at one man, but two. As Gar opened his mouth to shout, Pelin Oryk came running to join them, his uniform torn and filthy.
"Your Majesty! Your Majesty, forgive the interruption. Asher's friend, Stablemeister Matt, he's taken."
Stunned shock congealed into pain.
"Let him go, Conroyd," he said. "Asher's dead now. It's over. Please let him go."
Conroyd turned on him, wholly himself again.
"Get back to your tower and stay there, runt. I'll know if you're straying, and you won't like my wrath."
"Matt. Matt."
Anguished, despairing, Gar turned away without looking again at the burned body at his feet. The square was almost emptied now, the dais entirely deserted. The carriage that had brought him here was waiting a little distance away, the golden crown on the falcon's head flashing in the guttering glimfire. He climbed inside, and let it take him home through the thronged and noisy streets. His wounded cheek throbbed, unmerciful. True to his word, of course, Darren was waiting up for him, took one look at his cut and blood-stained face and cried out in alarm.
"Sir! Sir, what's happened? You're injured!"
Either he needed to get properly drunk right now, or he should never touch ice wine again. Ignoring Darren's outstretched hand, his peppering of incoherently anxious questions, Gar paced around the foyer floor, struggled to make sense of events that were incredibly senseless, totally impossible. He was brought up short by Darren, who abandoned a lifetime of protocol, grabbing him by the arm and dragged him to a halt.
"Sir! Sir, you're frightening me!"
Shocked, Garl looked at the old man, saw that yes, indeed, his secretary, his friend, was frightened. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to." Appalled at himself, Darren unclutched his fingers and stepped back.
"Please, sir, I understand how you feel. What's happened is a tragedy, but it's not your fault, and you mustn't go on blaming yourself. Asher's death..."
Gar held up a silencing finger, leaned close, whispered,
"Asher's not dead."
From the look on the old man's face, it was clear Darren thought he'd lost his mind.
"Oh, sir, please, let me take you upstairs, help you lie down and find medicine for your wound. You've had a terrible shock and..."
He seized Darren's black-clad shoulders and shook him. "Listen to me! Asher's not dead. Someone is. Someone died tonight cruelly and bloodily. But that someone wasn't Asher!" Dumbly, Darren stared at him.
"Wasn't Asher?" he said at last. "How can you be..."
Shuddering, he saw again that burned and blackened body, smelled the wrenching stink of fresh-cooked flesh. "A missing scar. You've seen it on his right arm, an injury he got as a boy. The man killed tonight didn't have it. He wasn't Asher."
"Then who?"
"I have no idea," he said, and let Darren go. Began pacing again, his head pounding with thoughts and ideas and pain. But it can only mean one thing. Asher was rescued.
"Rescued? Oh, sir, I mean no disrespect, but..."
He spun about. "Matt's arrested. He was there, Darren. He was involved somehow. I know it." Looking uncomfortable, Darren cleared his throat.
"Don't you know? Asher and Matt parted uncivilly, sir. At the risk of sounding ghoulish, isn't it possible that Matt returned merely to witness..."
"No!" Frustration was afire, burning. Perhaps if he banged Darren's thick head on the nearest wall, he'd see what had to be seen. "At least, yes, it's possible, but I don't think it's the answer. I can't explain it. Call it intuition, desperation, whatever you like. But I know Matt was here to rescue Asher, and he didn't come alone. Asher got away, helped by people who wanted to keep him alive, and I doubt they were Doranan."
"Ulken?" Darren whispered. "You mean, more of our kind like Asher?"
"I don't know about that. I don't know who they are or what they want. All I know is we have to find them somehow, because they can lead us to Asher."
"No, sir!"
Darren was so upset he didn't seem to notice he'd raised his voice to his prince.
"It's too dangerous! If Asher's alive, then I'm glad of it for his sake. But you cannot meddle further. To do so could mean your life. You could die."
"And if I don't meddle, Darren, it could mean the death of this kingdom." Darren's face crumpled with despair.
"Oh, sir, sir, why won't you accept it? The kingdom's dead already. At least it's dead to you. Conroyd is our king now. Lur's livelihood rests with him."
Again, he took the old man by the shoulders, and this time held him gently, as though his bones could break.
"You don't understand, Darren," he whispered. "There's something..."